But the principle involved has something about it that is very beautiful. The principle of preserving, of taking care, of loving, of doing everything possible to protect life. In the older days, the Japanese people, when they wrote a letter or threw away some scrap paper, never threw away a piece of paper without, first of all, burying it, because it had words on it. And these words might be very important words. You just didn't throw away words. If you didn't need them, you put them away where they would be permanently taken care of by nature. These things are sentimental in the extreme. There's no question about it. But you can be on the other side of the situation and be so unsentimental that you gradually lower the integrity of your own heart. You're not thoughtful anymore. You're not kind anymore. You're perfectly satisfied to hurt anything you feel like hurting as long as it pleases you. This is not good. I was talking not long ago with a nutritionist of considerable standing. I don't want to name anybody, but there was a prominent person. And they told me, they said, you know, there's one of the greatest troubles of the American people at the present time is that they're eating far too much meat. They're going to pay for it. They're going to pay for these $5 steaks, and it's not going to be in terms of money. All of these tremendous overdoings of things, these catering to appetites at the expense of integrities, this useless waste of life that we have become adjusted to, is part of the cause of our troubles. Experiments in Scandinavia during and after World War II proved definitely that there was much more nutrition by you eating the grain the cow ate than there was to eating the meat of the cow afterwards. And the grain had none of the toxic consequences or by-consequences that we are a little worried about. So somewhere beneath doing it right, there is also a permanent good. There is a realization of value. There is a protection of health. There is a protection of life. Now, it doesn't always follow that a bad disposition shortens one's years. I know several rather aged people who have done very well by nursing their grievances, as far as years are concerned. But the day they began to nurse them, they really died anyway, because they lived for nothing but to carry on the unpleasantnesses which they had made to appear important. But actually, health is better advanced by First and Second Corinthians than by any other physical medical formula that can be set up. If you are kind, if you are gentle, if you are tolerant, if you are self-disciplined, if you think through the things you do and give the same love to your health that you have given to some emotional pleasure, you will be better off also. Now, many people fall in love with themselves, it is said, but it's the wrong way. There is a way of doing it, however, that is constructive. One is to recognize that your body is a structure that needs tender guidance, constant care, thought, justice, integrity. It needs humor, it needs variation, it needs everything possible. And if you really want to love a body and keep it healthy, you'll treat it right. And you can gain just as much peace of mind by knowing that your body is getting the help that it needs. It's part of also the idea to live lovingly in all things, and in all things not too much, was the Platonic and Socratic statement. Now today we are looking all over the world for the answers to something. We know we're not getting there as we should, and we don't know what to do about it. I think that instead of trying to find out who is the noblest among them, the leaders in all forms and walks of life should realize that whether it is in one sacred book or another sacred book, it is in all of them. Namely, that love is the answer to the solution of everything that arises from discord. If the individual can transcend self-interest, selfishness, if he will mature his own inner life, there won't be any more holy wars, which is one of the most ghastly contradictions that there is in life. There will be no longer these terrible feuds. We will not have crime rampant as it is now. If people cared for each other, had an honest affection, and were able, therefore, to turn their activities into labors of mutual benefit, there's no reason why people getting along happily together cannot have a wonderful time through these years of life. Maybe they won't be so rich, maybe they won't be so powerful, but they will have knowledge of values that otherwise they could never have. And of course, you can do this without actually proclaiming anything. It's not necessary to go out and wave a flag. It is simply necessary to begin to behave yourself. And in the course of time, you will be surprised on how it counts. You will learn a little bit at a time that when you are a friend, you will have friends. The people who begin to appreciate your integrity will give you an understanding which you cannot get any other way. So on this Easter morning, I think we ought to very deeply appreciate the fact that to the Christian world, Jesus Christ is the embodiment of divine love. He is the embodiment of that great good which rests forever in the heart of eternity. He bears witness to the way of life in the house of dark places. He came to set a symbol upon us that we should obey the simple instruction of virtue, that we all can know what peace is. And by becoming aware of the grandeur of it, we can help to share it. Someday we can walk out of this nation into another nation or around the world without a boundary, without papers, without spies, without espionage. These things are part of a stupidity that has afflicted mankind from the beginning. Why? Why did the human being always put the wrong foot forward? Well, one of the reasons was because he was selfish. Selfishness is perfectly willing to sacrifice almost anything else for the advancement of itself. Ambition has created more miseries than almost all other forms of lawbreaking. The unbridled determination to achieve worldly accomplishment, fame, and distinction. The idea of marrying for money. The idea of nobly quoting and watching for opportunities to discredit someone else so that we can take their place. All this type is foolish. The wealthy families are not happy. And today we can see by the press the miseries they're in. No one can be happy because he has broken the rules. But very few people are strong enough to keep the rules. Now, there's another side also to this problem, and that is, how are we going to escape the pressures around us? A great many people have always decided the fight was too hard. So they have retired from the world. They have taken on sacred orders. They have departed into distant places. They have built hermitages on the tops of mountains. They have decided to renounce mankind because they can't live with it any longer. So they go off by themselves, and this again is a complete mistake. No individual can become more proficient in the realization of the divine plan for man. No one can become more proficient unless he is in there fighting. Fighting in a sense of living from day to day, keeping the faith, keeping the truth in the presence of adversity and animosities, staying with it. Because it is only by staying with it that we grow. It is only then when we are tempted to do wrong that our virtues are worth anything. To run away from temptation is not to be strong, it's to be very weak. But to stay where we are, in the place where we are, and take on the job the best we can, has its rewards. Now, a person is not expected to make a complete change of everything that they are. But we can, I think, do a great deal of good every day by trying in simple ways to cultivate a few constructive attitudes and relationships. One common thing we should all think about is to try and find how to bring children and parents into closer understanding, how to find out the principles upon which mutual respect can be built. To do this may take quite a bit of thought, particularly if it has been delayed until wrong foundations are deeply laid. But anywhere around us, where there is an animosity, an antagonism, wherever there's a prejudice or conceit, we can go to work on it. We can determine to the best of our ability that we are going to become truly religious people. For as we find in the Bible, if you love me, keep my commandments. Many people say they love God or love Christ, but they do not keep the commandments. Now, if these commandments were a bunch of superstitions, as lots of people would like to think they are, it would all be different. But there, no one has ever proven that the commandments as given by Jesus are superstitions. No one has ever been able to prove that the world can gain anything by breaking them. But there are many ways of proving beyond doubt that we can gain tremendously by keeping them. Whether they were devised by some mortal in ancient times, or whether they came directly from heaven, is not important. They are the basis of a conduct by which we can survive. They are the basis of relationships which are necessary to our own well-being. Therefore, they are worth thinking about. We know that we can, with effort, make changes in ourselves. So, let us think now, not of what heaven can do for us, but what we can do to advance truth in our own lives. Advance beauty and integrity. Advance common affection and regard. Know the neighbors. Know the friends. Try to understand people in trouble. And if there is spare time, nothing to do, don't waste it. Try to use it for the common good. Many people today would be far happier and wiser and better if they'd cut down the television program and donate time and energy to constructive philanthropies. This business of constantly pleasing ourselves, thoughtless of the effect of others, or by simply believing that we give a dollar, that takes care of everything. The gift without the giver is bad. The entire problem of life is to gradually release, in a sense, the Christ quality through ourselves. The Christ in you, the hope of glory. The Christian principles being lived by each of us in our daily life. These, when they flow from us, become virtually a second coming. These principles coming forth from us return the Christ power to the world and return to man the peace and tranquility of inner security. Therefore, it is very important to try to find some way the presence of God, to practice the presence of God, to live every day, not in a smug theological way. We don't even have to think of it that way. Instead of thinking of it being going to make us theologians, let us thus say it's going to make us better parents, better husbands and wives, and better citizens of the community. We don't have to hang any theological tassels on it. All we have to say is that it's common sense. And that common sense just happens to correspond instructively with the way of God. Because after all, we are part of a universe that is run by common sense, and we are the weak spots in the link. And we have to do something to take care of this. After all, this is not making a theologian out of us simply because we're honest. It simply makes a decent human being out of us. And out of the cultivation of those gentle virtues which make possible true love, we are also keeping faith with the great principles of integrity which support our world. It is very important, therefore, that we do find out a little more about love. The Neoplatonists of Alexandria also developed a code or a creed of how to understand love. They had all kinds of love listed and tried to understand it. And they made a kind of an order out of it, a sort of a scale. And then at the top of the scale, they put love of God. This being the supreme adoration, the highest possible attitude of human consciousness toward reality. This was a tremendous upsurge of love, of veneration, of adoration to that eternal power upon which we are all dependent for our existence. The one power that is the parent of all that lives and has always been and always will be the benevolent parent, except that we do not recognize or keep the rules of that benevolence. The second on the line of love was veneration for the saints and sages, for those who by one power or another had dedicated their lives to the instruction of their fellow men, who had unselfishly taught the very truths and principles that are essential. Some of these were persecuted, some of them were martyred, but they are the heroes of the world, the greatest of all human beings. Therefore, we have a proper reason to respect them, to admire them, to venerate them, and to consider with gratitude their presence in our world. Therefore, another factor in love is gratitude. The ungrateful lover is in a bad way. The third level, of course, was a little different type of thing, but stop of the same thing. And that is the love that we bestow upon all kinds of things in nature. The love we have for the sky and the earth that enables us to go out as Lao Tzu did in China and sit under a tree on bank of a little river and there commune with the infinite. The love that steps out of itself to embrace all these natural things. Gratitude for the wonderful privileges of existence. Gratitude for the sunsets and the sunrise. Gratitudes for the fecundity of the earth, for all the benefits we enjoy. This is a gratitude which makes us always in debt to the universe to which we belong. A debt which we must pay by service, by integrity, by idealism. Now the next level of the affections dealt with more or less political subjects. The love of humanity comes first. The fact that basically, regardless of how impossible they are, we love them all. There's a great love underneath. We do not excuse the spoilage, but we seek under it for those little human beings who are suffering from their own mistakes, often without knowing why, often without understanding the very destiny that they have brought upon themselves. We love them all, we want to help them, and we wish them well. The next one, of course, is one more common to us, the love of nation or race, the great tree to which we personally belong, the branch of life which is our own. We have a certain love for our own culture, our own arts, our own sciences, our own heroes. We believe in the integrity of our own peoples, and there is a certain inevitable veneration for the background of our own personal lives, so that becomes the second. The next one is the natural love for family and all that it represents. We recognize the integrity of the pattern we have set up, and we'll do everything possible to make it a success. And to make it a success, we must honestly love the members of that family and place their happiness, security, and well-being above the gratification of our own appetites. We can never do anything for our own benefit that is hurtful to another if we love them. If we can perform the hurtful act, it is because we do not love. Then there is also the love of other kingdoms in nature, of birds and beasts and flowers. There is love of beauty, love of virtue, love of integrity, love of all the different levels of human achievement. There's love of music, the love of the dance. Every constructive expression of human attitudes or attitudes can be interpreted as causes of joy, causes of happiness, expressions which we can interpret in terms of love. So gradually must come to the final decision that love must finally love the beautiful. Up to a certain point, it may not appear that way, but the love will leave nothing incomplete. It must carry on and make everything beautiful, everything filled with goodness. Love takes the imperfect and inspires it to greater perfections, but never by means of positive or intolerant indoctrinations. The actual fact is, as the poets have found long ago, that there is no real need, really, for a special education in selecting objects for devotion. The only thing is to relax away from what is not right. You can sit quietly by the side of a mountain or stream, and you can, in that quietude, reconstruct the universe. You can restore your own relationships with it. You can become aware of the transcendent beauty of life as life. All of the false things can fall away. And in quietude and silence, you can learn to recognize the infinite benediction and blessedness of the divine plan. Also in the quietude of your own home, in the silence and sympathies of the day, you can quietly contemplate the labors of love. You can realize how is gradually you can transmute the antagonisms that have you've nursed through the years. You can love again things that you have forgotten or have renounced because of your own misunderstandings. So out of it all comes the Christian story, the story of love that was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we knew it not. And we persecuted it. And we allowed it to perish rather than to take over our lives and give us a share of life everlasting. Today we are again persecuting it. We are again failing. This time not really because we can't do better, but because the pressures of diversified privileges make it a little easier to be thoughtless of others and seek our own advantage. As we do this, however, the momentum of disaster builds up. We are in more and more trouble every day, and we do not know why we are in this trouble. We only know that the crime record is way up. We only know that delinquency is more prevalent, that alcoholism is becoming a greater curse, that drug addiction is also on the gain among human beings, and most of those who are involved either as sufferers or distributors of death have read the Bible or know about it. They know the Christian virtues. They know what the word honesty means. But for some unknown reason, they don't practice what they claim to accept. Why then should we not realize that unless the individual begins to work for a cause that is worthwhile, that he cannot make much of a contribution to life as it is? It is not possible for the average individual to turn around and change the course of politics or to get rid of the different difficulties in cultural strata. But each of us can do a little job right at home. Each of us can finally decide that we will have peace in our intimate circles of acquaintances, that we will live together in peace. Not because it is a great effort, not because we're going to frustrate our every instinct and become hopeless neurotics because we try to be peaceful, but because peace is the natural state of the human soul. Peace within the individual is the secret of security in the outer part of him. If his inner life is deformed by all kinds of antagonisms, antipathies, and appetites, he cannot be well, he cannot be happy, he cannot think clearly, he cannot do a good day's work, and he can't keep a job. All of these things work together to the simple recognition that blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are they that hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. The great blessings of life come to those who weigh and carefully consider the quiet acceptance of the Christ principle, of the continuous effort not only to be Christ-like, which means to be Christian, but also to realize that there is a little Christ in each of us that can also go out and reach to those who are a little more needy even than ourselves. The life of Christ is a life of unselfish service, of dedication to principles, and of the gradual uniting of all differences and all antagonisms. The life of Christ is a life of peace in the light of God. It is man finally making peace with the universe to which he belongs, a peace that will bring him in safety through the orbits of the stars and the planets and out into space. Everywhere in space there is great peace, great silence, great and eternal order. Everywhere in the smallest things there are mathematical sequences. There is order, discipline, and law. And the greatest of all the laws is the law of love. For it is this law by which all things are transformed. It is the great alchemical transformer. It is the mystery of the elixir of life and the powder of projection. For love takes the commonplace and transforms it into precious metal. It takes the common occurrence and the common experience and makes it sacred. It takes the daily life, which apparently is mediocre, and makes it a brilliant and marvelous experience of the Spirit. Wherever love comes, it brings with it life. When it departs, life goes with it. So in these difficult times, love must be interpreted not in terms of personal satisfaction or emotional success, not in terms of passion, not in terms of anger, not in terms of lust, but in terms of unselfish dedication to the good of others. Any other form of love is in vain. But if this first dedication is given, then all other forms of affection are ennobled, made more beautiful, made greater, and more necessary to our daily lives. It is up to each individual, therefore, to try to do something to make himself stronger and wiser and better. So I think the transmuting power, the wonderful transmutation of love, is something that we should all really think about. The alchemists were supposed to be in search of the elixir of life. And it is probably true that a true love, bringing with it discipline and proper ordering of life, can extend years tremendously. Another thing, an individual can live longer if he is not thinking about himself. If he's at a job that is important to him, he will live till it is finished. Everything points to the dedication away from self, away from personal satisfactions, and certainly away from catering to the weaknesses of human nature. It will not be possible to correct all these weaknesses at once, or maybe for a long time, but we can start a little. We can plant the seed of piety, the mustard seed of the scriptural parable. And by planting this mustard seed, it shall grow into a great tree. And the individual who plants within himself the seed of devotion, who really allows love to become part of his life, if he allows this power that is all forever knocking at the door to come in, and he finds in his own heart a little germ of love, a little seed of a greater and more beautiful relationship with life, he can build it until it becomes a magnificent part of his complete personality. Also, there is every reason to assume, from what we know, that he can take this with him, that when he goes into the other life beyond, the love that he has here will continue to lead and guide him. For the person who loves God, loves nature, loves his fellow man, loves his world, and respects himself, there is very little problem of purgatory or any other unpleasant post-worldly condition. If the person has lived a comparatively constructive life and has done the best they could to make his life useful rather than so-called successful in terms of wealth, if he is living the principles, he can face the future with just as much peace of heart and soul. For the love that he has used in this world will go to with him, and as Walt Whitman tells us in one of his poems, that actually love loves death, and by so doing it, has a victory over it forever. That death itself can be loved because of the tremendous opportunities it confers, but most people only fear it. So everywhere the virtue is important. Your Indian mystics and sages also were very much indebted to the love principle for their wisdom. They used it largely in their meditative and contemplative exercises. One of the things that they did was to try to create the transcendent being within themselves. Knowing what they are and what they do in daily life, they chose to meditate upon the fact that within themselves is another being, a being which they can visualize, that they can create by visualization, that they can actually put together by their own thoughts and their own dedications. They can visualize inwardly a beautiful transcendent being, which is themselves. That this transcendent being is godlike in all its parts, because it is God. That this transcendent being lives only to do good, to achieve all that is possible for the good of mankind. And that the message of this transcendent being is, don't think about yourself. Don't try to be good. Don't try to be wise. Rather, try to love and to serve and to be grateful. And gradually the transcendent being takes over, and the individual finds that this soul power within himself, which is now locked within him, can become the ruler of his life. And when soul takes victory over matter, that you have the beginning of immortality. All the good works of man have to be blessed by the simple fact that man has kept faith, that he has kept the principles of religion, that he has used them in daily construction of worldly problems, the daily interpretation of the commonplace, but in so doing has continued to build within himself the over-self, that is mysterious and wonderful power, which is the power of soul over body. This type of realization is really the height of Christianity. It was the attitude of the early Christian mystics. And there were mystics and mystery schools and systems in Christianity that are very little understood. But in all of them, all Christianity in its beginnings was consummated by the personal experience of Christ. The believer had to achieve that calmness, that quietude, that peace, that true spirit of reverence, that wonderful acceptance of the divine will. And that became the basis of the mystical experience. And the mystical experience was the only definition of love that we have ever been able to formulate that had much meaning. It was the mere fact that the individual suddenly felt himself picked up into a marvelous union in which he became again like the small babe, who was perfectly happy, perfectly confident, at peace, and completely strong, held in the arms of its mother. That there was no arbitrary motives, no ulterior thoughts, the little child reached out its hands in pure and simple love. With a strange feeling, intuitive, that this love would be returned. And this is what mysticism really was. It was the child heart in man reaching out to the eternal parent with complete certainty that that parent can never fail. This is the type of thing that we call childlike, but it is probably far more mature than anything we know. And at this time, we all need to find some source of good. And the source of good can be a dedication. It can be a determination to come a little nearer to the mystery of love by weeding out, one by one, attitudes that are not loving, attitudes that are not kind, attitudes that are not beautiful. If we can do these things, we not only fulfill our destiny, but we are Christians. And until this happens, we are somewhere on the outside looking through the bars at something that we have forbidden ourselves the right to experience. So on this occasion of Easter, as a part of our divine year, so to say, we have a new birth of the Spirit in ourselves. We have the resurrection and the proof, the eternal proof, that there is in man the power to redeem him. And that power to redeem man in men is God. And that this power is in all of us. And when we are tired of being sick, tired of being miserable, tired of being cruel, we have always the perfect right to express through ourselves the healing grace of God. We can be agents of the release of the divine through our own natures. This is something we should all work towards. We won't all make it right away, but we can all try, and the first effort will be just a little more peace, a little better understanding, more friendship, less worry, less fear, and most of all, a greater sense of belonging to a divine plan by which we were fashioned, by which we will be perfected, and that we are beginning to walk along the road that leads back to the divinity from which we came. If we keep these thoughts in mind, we will not only be good Christians, and better Christians at least, but also we'll be better people, just better human beings, better able to solve the very pressing material problems of existence. For the victory of spirit over matter is the victory of solution over problem. And the victory of soul over body is the victory of truth over error. These things can be worked for, and if we work with them carefully, we will be well rewarded. In the meantime, have a happy Easter. I'd like to announce at this time that we will have a memorial service at 1 o'clock here in the auditorium for a friend of the society whom we have all known for a great many years, and the husband of Mrs. Thomas, who is a librarian and whose husband passed on recently. So we'll have a little memorial service at 1 o'clock, and you're all invited if you wish to attend. Thank you very much.